Satan people, claimed to be Satanists, claimed to be involved in black magic.
And more stuff is coming out now also, how much the Bush administration ignored the intelligence. It was almost like they ignored it because they wanted it to happen.
Remember, what's crazy about this story is that the police arrested him on Sunday by accident.
The tyrant dies, and his rule is over. The martyr dies, and his rule begins.
Satan can take the form of a beautiful woman. Satan can take the form of a sleek animal. An automobile can be very satanic.
Hello, and welcome to Historica Esoterica. It's been a while, listeners. Hello. It's good to see you.
Yeah.
I'm your friend and host, Matt K. Ultra, joined, as always, by...
Sub-Project Roswell.
And in case the title and artwork and new theme didn't tip you off, we're doing something a little different this time around. So we're going to, this episode will be a little more scripted than our usual stuff. It'll be a little more serious than our usual stuff.
Yeah.
But we wanted to say hello before we started all of that.
Yeah. We missed you.
Yeah. And also we're sorry.
But also you're welcome.
Yeah. And also you're welcome. Yeah. We recorded our episode on Scientology and then fell off the face of the earth for several months, which.
Yeah. Which you read that how you want. Yeah. You can interpret that however you may.
I would like to note we want to take back everything we said. pending litigation.
So we're talking about MKUltra, which is a pretty big topic. And our studious listener might notice that this is episode 1.0, and we're actually going to be talking to everything leading up to MKUltra. But not actually MKUltra itself. We're going to be laying a lot of groundwork.
Yeah, there will not be a ton of MK talk on this one. Yeah. Artichoke, on the other hand, I mean, who can say?
Who knows?
We know. But the rest of you guys don't yet.
So before we hop into our information, we just wanted to get just to briefly touch base because the original thought we had on this podcast – when we were so young and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, back when we were talking about grimoires and it was all cute, it was kind of like to do a broad overview for like me, who's new to a lot of this stuff, and kind of delve into this stuff for the layman. So this will be a little bit more researched than some of our previous ones, but it's still kind of going to be that because, as we'll see by this, there's so many rabbit holes you can fall down with this specific topic. Yeah, so anyway, I think a good way to start it off is to kind of talk about the misconception of like what MKUltra is to a lot of people and then how we first came across it. So my understanding of MKUltra, and you tell me whether or not you agree with this, was that it was the US government, I guess the CIA specifically, using mind-altering drugs like LSD to do mind control, but mind control's not real. It didn't work. And then the wonderful, lovely hippies got their hands on it and free love happened and the world was saved. That's kind of the narrative I'd always heard about it. It's like, look at these dumb squares. They didn't realize what the monster they created. And that was my conception of it from just like a glancing understanding. How about you?
Yeah, I was very similar. I've been interested in conspiracies for a very long time. So the first time I read about MKUltra was probably in like fifth or sixth grade, honestly. Like going through some like giant tome of conspiracy theories.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I saw something about Project MK Ultra, which just has an impact to
it's
it,
a
right?
Good like, name, yeah.
And so, yeah, my first thoughts about MK Ultra were probably, whoa, that sounds cool. and it isn't cool. Just want to go on record and say that.
No,
yeah.
It's very uncool when you learn more about it.
But then after that, right, I probably around high school when I really started looking into things like this and started getting involved with like left-wing politics, it was very similar to what you had, right? Where it's like, yeah, the CIA invented LSD and then they started giving it to people and it escaped the lab.
Yeah.
And, you know, much like another thing that escaped the lab.
I was thinking it too.
I said those words and then realized what I had set myself up to do. Very similar to you, right? Like, you know, it's just a groovy little accident. And they never intended for it to make its way out of the lab. But
yeah.
Then the 60s happened. Completely accidentally and spontaneously.
Well, we'll get there. But that's a whole can of worms. But I kind of had a similar thing because like I've been interested in like – I don't want to say full-on conspiracy, but I was always interested in monsters and cover-ups and creepy stuff and like creepypasta. So like the way I came across MKUltra, I was probably 5th, 6th, 7th grade or whatever. I was reading about Polybius. I think we talked about this briefly.
Yeah, we did talk about that.
For the listener, Polybius, I don't know if it's – I actually haven't looked into it again, but it's this supposed arcade game in the 70s because I was way into arcade games in 5th grade. Don't ask me why. But it was the supposed arcade game, kind of like Caterpillar or Pong or whatever, like a cabinet that they would set up in arcade, you know, like actual what do they call those? Parlors? Whatever. So supposedly there's this Polybius cabinet that appeared in – somewhere in California in several different arcades, and it would like give people headaches and like weird like trances and stuff and like it had like weird messages and then it disappeared without a trace. And I remember reading that, and like one of the theories on the Wikipedia or whatever was that it was somehow related to MK Ultra or something like that. And I remember being well, what's MK Ultra, and then reading that and being like, no. So
it can't be.
So yeah, that's — and it's funny because like I think the whole reason I say that is like it is sort of something that has kind of been lurking on under the surface of the cultural psyche, because even me, who lives under a rock, heard about it somewhere. And I think a lot of people like have heard those words MK Ultra before, or like the idea of government mind control. It's like it's out in the the spirit of the country, the cultural mind. Yeah.
And like, I mean, even like memes, like, MK Ultra activation phrase is something that like, honestly, even like, the most like my most like normie, to use the term, but even like the most normal people I know will like laugh if you say that, because they understand what you're alluding to.
Yes, exactly.
So it's got a bit of a reputation, I think.
It does. And we're going to find out I was about to say for better or for worse, but just for worse. There's a lot more to it. And it just – it has so much to do with our recent history. And it's actually in a very macabre way, very fascinating. So I think without further ado, that sets us up nicely to set up MKUltra. So
all right. Yeah.
On with the show.
On with the scripted show. Oh. See you on the other side, listeners. Project MKUltra has always fascinated me. Officially running from 1953 through 1973, MKUltra has gone on to attain a somewhat mythic status within the public consciousness. The narrative many still believe is one of failure. The Central Intelligence Agency tried to develop a means of mind control, but accidentally pioneered the development and distribution of powerful psychedelics nationwide instead. Ask a less mainstream source, and your answers will vary wildly. MKUltra was a cover-up for something even worse. MKUltra was a complete success, and mind-controlled assassins roam the earth to this day. MKUltra tactics are being used on celebrities as we speak. There is something almost Lovecraftian about the sheer scale and magnitude of the activities carried out under the MKUltra umbrella, a sense of creeping horror that gnaws at the edge of one's mind while reading about it, a fear that one has succumbed to madness brought there by a thirst for knowledge. Fact is often stranger than fiction, when the two can be meaningfully distinguished from each other at all. Many accounts of MKUltra, rightfully, focus on the CIA's use of drugs on civilians, often without their consent. However, to exclusively discuss the horrifying fact that the American government knowingly drugged its own citizens is to miss the many other aspects of this program. Hypnotism, torture, electroshocks, and sexual abuse all play just as much of a role in the research that the agency carried out on its subjects, some of whom are not even adults. Studies on the long-term effects of trauma and abuse were carried out, alongside drug tests, but they are not discussed nearly as often in narratives about MKUltra. In 1973, CIA Director Richard Helms ordered that all documents relating to MKUltra be destroyed. Of the few documents that survived the order, some have been declassified, some have not. This story is far-reaching, interweaving with a number of other conspiracies, for lack of a better term, and infamous figures from American history. We will do our best to tell a complete story, but we cannot guarantee that we will be able to do so perfectly, or in a linear fashion, or that we will cover everything on our first go-around. Before we can do anything, however, we must understand the background of this program, looking at its predecessors and influences throughout history. Welcome to the debut episode of our MKUltra series, Laying the Groundwork.
So, to just give everyone a broad overview of what we're dealing with here. Like, if you want to imagine it like your role-playing game statistic, your sheet of stats, and just like just your basic understanding of what it even is before we get into the history, kind of touching on some of the things Matt just mentioned. But essentially, MKUltra was a project that was designed and undertaken by the Central Intelligence Agency. It involved 80 institutions, including 44 colleges and universities, in addition to prisons, hospitals, and pharmaceutical companies. It consisted of at least 149 sub-projects, which were contracted out to these various institutions, and at least 185 private researchers participated in the project. The indirect funding and nature of the project meant that many, if not most, involved were unaware that they were working with the CIA, and if they were maybe not sure as to what capacity or the extent of the experiment as a whole. The agency at the time was directed by Alan Dulles when the experiments began in the early 1950s and was under Richard Helms when it ended in 1973, as mentioned before. This means that it was active during the presidential terms of Dwight Eisenhower until Richard Nixon, and ended shortly after the Watergate scandal occurred, to kind of give you a cultural window into what happened, maybe put some other things in context. And it was partially headed by a chemist in the employ of the CIA, Sidney Gottlieb, who will be coming up often later on. He was the chief of the Office of Technical Service, formerly known as the Technical Service Staff, the TSS. So, with that, I think we can talk about hypnosis, mind control, and sort of its origins up to World War II.
Yeah, so hypnosis and mind control, as we think of them in our current day and age, really began getting off the ground in the beginning of the 20th century, right? So you have figures such as Milton H. Erickson, William Joseph Bryan, and George Estabrooks, all of whom will show up in these sorts of things constantly.
Yeah.
They all made leaps and bounds in the fields of hypnosis, and coincidentally, they all were also rubbing elbows with members of the Central Intelligence Agency.
And can I ask you,
subsidiaries? Yeah.
Did you? I guess we talked about mind control just to briefly cut in. We talked about mind control all the way back on our Manchurian Candidate episode, and I think you were a little bit more in the camp of believing in it, and I think I was very skeptical. So I think it's important for me to say I've very much flipped on that.
So have I. I don't believe it in it.
Oh, okay, cool. But I did want to touch base with you on that, because I think it's something that's going to be a lot of hard for a lot of people to swallow, is the idea that mind control, A, could be real, or B, that like a government would knowingly do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important to put. Like, we understand, I guess, at least.
Yeah, we
how
understand.
Crazy it is.
Yeah, and I think I was definitely friendlier to it back then, but I'm even more so in the camp of like, mind control is real now. That I have read a lot of documents from people going, we're doing mind control.
Right. And maybe it's not exactly like what you might think in the movies, but there is a truth to the base idea.
Yeah, it's never going to be like, you know, like a Batman cartoon where it's like all of a sudden Robin is working for the Joker or something,
right?
It's
exactly.
Never that overt.
Right.
It's there and it's present. So just keep that in mind. As we go forward, we'll probably do episodes specifically on this. This
We're
is
not
gonna
crazy.
Be our, We're not crazy. We promise.
Right.
But yeah. So Milton Erickson, one of the most influential hypnotists of the 20th century, served as the head of the American Society for Clinical Hypnosis and was a fellow of several other influential psychological associations. He, for our purposes, is most notable for pioneering several hypnotic techniques that other hypnotists, George Estabrooks in particular, would later take and build upon. He also, notably, held the view that hypnosis could be used to heal physical ailments. Mm. A claim strikingly similar to statements that another figure with connections to American intelligence, L. Ron Hubbard, would make about his own pet method, Dianetics. George Estabrooks, on the other hand, was a lot more interested in the potential that hypnosis held for applications in intelligence and warfare, and had frequent correspondences with J. Edgar Hoover, a fellow Mason and head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, about his ideas and concerns, although he often strained against the limits of his peers' willingness to go along with these experiments. In one section of his 1957 book, Hypnotism, Estabrooks waxes eloquent about the limits of testing out the pliability of a hypnotic subject, before then offering a note about the circumstances under which these limits may become a bit more malleable. Quote, "The only possible way of determining whether or not a subject will commit a murder in hypnotism is literally to have him commit one. No fake setup will satisfy the critics, for the hypnotized subject is not asleep. He is very wide awake, willing to cooperate in all kinds of fake murders with rubber knives. But with a real knife or a loaded revolver? No one knows, for the simple reason that no one dares find out. The police would not see the point when they viewed the corpse and were told that it was the result of a scientific experiment. Nor would the jury. Sing Sing in the electric chair would probably put an end to the career of that particular scientist. But warfare may, undoubtedly will, answer many of these questions. A nation fighting with its back to the wall is not very worried over the niceties of ethics. If hypnotism can be used to advantage, we may rest assured that it will be so employed. Any accidents which may occur during these experiments will simply be charged to profit and loss, a very trifling portion of that enormous wastage of human life, which is part and parcel of war."
Good God, dude.
Yeah, he was a real charmer, this guy. So the true extent of Estabrooks' hypnotic prowess remains somewhat foggy, because while he wrote extensively about the capabilities of a skilled hypnotist to bend others to his will, and those close to him later in life spoke about his habit of darkly alluding to massively successful experiments that he conducted with the CIA, he burned all of his journal entries from 1940 to 1945, so we won't ever know for certain. We do, however, know for a fact that he conducted experiments on a variety of demographics, including children, and that he wrote to J. Edgar Hoover about that. William Joseph Bryan, who, as a side note, is not to be confused with his great-grandfather, U.S. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, was yet another hypnotist who worked with the Central Intelligence Agency. His name will be familiar to anyone who knows much about the RFK assassination and Sirhan Sirhan, but that's a story for another time. He did research for CIA projects Artichoke and MKUltra, maintaining a fairly regular correspondence with Morse Allen, Artichoke's director, who will come up later, and was also very involved in acquiring a hypnotically induced confession from one Albert Henry DeSalvo, the so-called Boston Strangler. In 1969, he was found guilty of sexual misconduct against at least four women he had placed into hypnotic states, and he received a five-year probation from the California State Board of Medical Examiners. In 1977, he was found dead in a Las Vegas hotel room of a suspected heart attack. I mention all of this to paint a picture about the sort of people involved in these things.
Right.
It should be noted, however, that mind control was not simply the domain of hypnotists. Others, such as Dr. Jose Manuel Rodriguez Delgado, experimented with a more hands-on approach. So, born in Spain and later involved with, in the words of Patrick Bateman, that whole Yale thing, Delgado is most famous for his experiments with a device he called the Stimosiever, which was capable of sending signals directly to electrodes surgically implanted in the brains of targets. In his most famous and dramatic demonstration of its capabilities, he stood in an arena and allowed an enraged bull to charge directly at him, stopping it remotely seconds before it crashed into him. In another series of experiments, he bugged a cat, electronically transmitting the audio signals its ears picked up to a separate location. His first experiments on human subjects began in 1952, and they continued until he left the United States in 1974, amid a flurry of accusations that he was connected to the CIA and, more specifically, MKUltra. For what it's worth, he always denied working with the agency, but he did admit that he had done work for the Office of Naval Intelligence. In these human experiments, he was able to evoke a variety of emotional and physical responses from targets, even when they actively attempted to resist him. After failing to prevent himself from clenching his fist in response to electrical stimulation, one patient was quoted as saying, "I guess, doctor, that your electricity is stronger than my will." All of these characters, at this point, have been a little scattered throughout time, and they have largely been civilians. So, to provide a bit more of a structure to this sort of thing, let's take a step back. We're going to look at events, take a step back from a more chronological perspective, which is to say, let's talk about World War II and the Office of Strategic Services. As this program has discussed before, the OSS, the immediate precursor to the CIA, was involved in a variety of ethically dubious programs and operations throughout the war, many of which take an ominous subtext on when one reads about them with the CIA's future activities in mind. For instance, we have the fact that, at William J. Donovan's explicit request, the OSS worked in conjunction with a committee of scientists, which included DAA head Harry Anslinger and future narcotics agent and LSD dealer George H. White, who this program will address in greater detail later, to develop a truth drug, testing out everything from alcohol to cannabis to mescaline, and trying to figure out what would give them the best chances of covertly dosing a prisoner. If you'll forgive us, listener, we're just going to take a brief aside here, and I'm going to read a quote from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's story, The Final Problem, in which Sherlock Holmes describes the villain, Professor James Moriarty. Quote, "A criminal strain ran in his blood, which, instead of being modified, was increased and rendered infinitely more dangerous by his extraordinary mental powers. Dark rumors gathered around him in the university town, and eventually he was compelled to resign his chair and come down to London. He is the Napoleon of crime, Watson. He is the organizer of half that is evil, and of nearly all that is undetected in this great city." When William Donovan walked into the office of Stanley Lavelle, an American chemist, he informed him that he was looking for a Professor Moriarty of his own, and he believed Lavelle to be that man. We should, of course, bear in mind that this story comes directly from Lavelle's memoirs, so it should perhaps be taken with a grain of salt. But true or not, the fact that he decided to tell that story is, in my opinion, somewhat telling. For the remainder of his time at the OSS, Lavelle would serve as the head of the office's Department of Research and Development, nicknamed the Dirty Tricks Department. This office was responsible for the creation of most of the OSS's gadgets, as well as some of its more outlandish schemes. Lavelle at one point looked into the possibility of using a hypnotized assassin to kill Adolf Hitler. Meanwhile, Nazi scientists across the pond were also looking into the effects of psychedelic drugs and hypnotism for mind control and truth serum purposes, testing out the effects of mescaline, occasionally paired with hypnosis, on concentration camp prisoners. With this fact in mind, let us continue our delightful jaunt through the intelligence history of World War II. As the war came to a close, American intelligence agents scrambled to gather up as many Nazi scientists as they could, eager to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Soviets. Dragnet operations, including Operation Overcast, and then later the more infamous Operation Paperclip, scooped up thousands of Nazi scientists, shielding many of them from trials and for their war crimes, and freeing others from prison after they served laughably short prison terms, recruiting them into the growing Cold War intelligence machine. Somewhat less discussed is the American push for the pardon of officers in Japanese units 731 and 100, all of whom were responsible for a slew of war crimes and experiments just as horrific as those of the Nazis. U.S. intelligence officers actively covered up the crimes these men were responsible for and paid them for information about their experiments, including, notably, the use of biological weapons, such as smallpox, on Chinese civilians. After the end of the Second World War, Alan Dulles would bring Stanley Lavelle in as a consultant to assist in the formation of the newly approved Central Intelligence Agency. Lavelle, perhaps unsurprisingly, was firmly convinced that the agency needed to have its own research and development branch, stating, quote, "Warfare is no longer a matter of chivalry, but of subversion, and subversion has its own special arsenal of tools and weapons. Only research and development is capable of creating such an arsenal," end quote. Dulles evidently took his words to heart and created a dirty tricks department of his own, the Technical Services Staff. But we'll just put a pin in that for now and come back to it later. Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron, who would go on to work on MKUltra subproject 68, was also sent in to do a psychiatric evaluation of Rudolf Hess at the Nuremberg trials. So, there were a lot of people floating around, these ex-Nazis. Ex, I guess, to be taken with a grain of salt.
In name only.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it should, at this point, I want to restate, the CIA was far from the only group investigating the potential when it came to using drugs in warfare or hypnotism and those sorts of things. For instance, from 1948 to 1975, the U.S. Army Chemical Corps carried out human experiments at the Edgewood Arsenal facility in Maryland, and they tested out everything from nerve compounds and LSD to alcohol and caffeine on American soldiers, recording the results. Soviet advances in these fields were often cited as the reason for the urgent need for human testing. Keep that trick in mind as we go forward. And one Otto Ambrose was among the scientists carrying out experiments at Edgewood. If his name doesn't sound familiar, it should, because while working at IG Farben, Ambrose helped develop sarin. The A in sarin stands for Ambrose, along with several other nerve agents. After the war, he was found guilty of mass murder and slavery, but was released after a mere 8 years in prison in 1951. He took part in nerve gas experiments at Edgewood when he wasn't working for Dow Chemicals or a slew of West German pharmaceutical companies. And again, I don't want to get too caught up in programs that the CIA wasn't officially involved in, but it's important to me that we reiterate the fact that American experiments in these fields weren't exclusive to MKUltra or even the CIA.
No.
And that's what we're focusing on for the purposes of this series, because I went a little insane when I tried to chart out everything and all of the agencies that have been looking into this.
Yeah.
But
well, and I think it serves to just tell you kind of the general state of mind of the American military and the intelligence machine at the time. And I do want to interject, because we talked briefly about Soviet advances. In our Manchurian Cabinet episode, I went a little hard on the Soviets, not on purpose. It was because it was the only sources I could find on mind control were it was studies from a book on mind control, and it was talking about tactics that the Soviet Union would use on captured soldiers, prisoners of war. I realized at the time that it was a bit slanted, but the more and more we delve deep into this, I'm kind of like, I want to recan a little bit on that, because I'm like, I don't think they were as crazy about this stuff as, or they certainly weren't as crazy about this stuff as the American intelligence agencies were. So, sorry, Stalin.
The arc of history is long, but it bends in favor of justice, as I always say.
Okay, all righty. Well, to continue laying the groundwork and kind of start to get into things that are sort of directly related to MKUltra but aren't, we're going to move on to Project Chatter. So in the stream of time, we're just after World War II has ended, and a lot of, you know, the world is kind of reshaping to fit the Cold War mold that we would see for the next, 50 years. So one of the projects that was involved in this was Project Chatter, which was undertaken by the United States Navy. Here they are again. Project Chatter began in the fall of 1947. And it was operated under the direction of Charles Savage of the Naval Medical Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, from 1947 to 1953, which means it overlapped with Projects Bluebird, Artichoke, and, of course, MKUltra. Something to keep in mind. So the goal, the stated goal, was the identification and testing of drugs in interrogations and recruitment of agents. And I'm actually just going to read from one of the documents uncovered from the Freedom of Information Act. I'm going to pick and choose a few quotes here, but this is from the introduction on their research. It says, quote, "A study has been made of the effect of lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD 25, on the effect, cognition, and expression of the, quote, normal, unquote, control subjects and of depressed patients. Studies were done on 20 subjects, 5 normal controls, and 15 depressed patients. The sole criterion of normalcy was that the individual functioned adequately in his immediate life situation. The normal controls were each given a single oral dose of 20 micrograms before breakfast. Psychological and physiological observations were carried out over a period of 8 to 15 hours. The depressed patients were begun on an oral dose of 20 micrograms, which was increased daily up to a point where a definite psychophysiological effect could be observed. This point varied in different patients from 20 to 100 micrograms. Psychological and physiological studies were carried out before, during, and after the course of treatment with LSD. Treatment was carried out over a period of a month, except where it had been interrupted for medical reasons, end quote. Just notice the slight difference in the way they treated the depressed to the normal
patient.
Slight margin of error. So the conclusions of these tests were that LSD had an effect on cognition, mood, and motor functions, leading to an eidetic and vegetative state. In addition, the LSD was seen as having some therapeutic effects on depressed patients, according to the documents. But the interesting thing was reading on like the final, you know, like stats and like conclusions, I didn't find a lot of plus sides. So I'll read you some of the final. Yeah. So two patients with involutional psychoses made complete recoveries. So that is good. Four suffering from schizophrenic reactions showed no improvement or became worse. Five schizoid persons with severe depressive reactions improved so that they became free of depression but remained schizoid. Four were transferred before they could finish their treatments, and two had to be removed from treatments due to the development of profound circulatory depression. And two of the control group who had no therapy, no LSD, improved as well. So unrelated. So
this was of,
go ahead.
I was going to say, this was, of course, the last time that psychedelics were used to try and treat depression or any other mental illnesses,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. It never, ever happened again. But it's kind of hard to tell from the documentation, but it really seems unlikely that the subjects were clear about the nature of their treatment.
Okay.
So and that's kind of the long and the short of it. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a smaller thing, but it does kind of set up and feed into the next project.
Yeah, it sets us up nicely for the next project, Project Bluebird. So I don't have much on this because Bluebird was honestly a kind of short-lived operation. Mm-hmm. It lasted from 1949 through 1951, and it was succeeded by Project Artichoke, which there's a lot more. There's a lot more information on Artichoke floating around, since that was the direct predecessor of MKUltra. But the CIA collaborated with Army, Navy, and Air Force intelligence officers on this project, and it was headed by one Morse Allen, who also headed up Artichoke. And he was a man with a long-standing interest in mind control, and according to some anecdotes, he had a habit of dosing coffee pots with LSD and hypnotizing his secretaries to shoot guns which he had unloaded without their knowledge at each other. So,
good guy.
A real charmer.
Yeah.
Like I said, lots of just great people all around hanging out in these operations.
Mm-hmm.
But in spite of the short run, it was still a very eventful project. For instance, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, a scientist whose name may ring a bell and, like we said, will certainly be coming up later,
right,
joined as a chemist, assisting in operations, and for the time being, staying mostly out of the spotlight. He wasn't quite as important as he would be later.
Right.
And in this time, the agency also hired Dr. Kurt Plutner, a Nazi scientist who had experimented on Jews and Soviet POWs at Dachau in search of a truth serum.
Mm-hmm.
Sound familiar? So he administered mescaline to the prisoners, inducing displays of schizophrenic behavior.
Yeah, and to cut in here, I also had, and you know, just something off the cuff, I had heard, and I think I got this from Program to Chill, so apologies, Jimmy Fallon Gong, for stealing this. But in the specific block of Dachau that they were on, they would also put on what they called the circus, the prisoner's circus, where they would force to dress people up, you know, cross-dressing and other stuff like that, which does kind of like sort of, not quite, but it almost ticks that box of sexual abuse that we're going to see with some of these later studies. So you can kind of see a through line from that into this later stuff.
There are a lot of very direct threads
right.
from what scientists like this were doing at these camps and what the Central Intelligence Agency later would go on to do.
Right.
But fortunately, those are all coincidences.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's nothing to worry
it's,
about.
None of it's connected, as we always say.
Of course. Yeah, that's our big thing.
Yeah.
One Boris Pasch, an Army intelligence officer who would later go on to work at the CIA, recruited Plutner in 1945, allowing him to continue his research, which would be foundational for the LSD experiments that the agency would later conduct. And Dr. Plutner, for his part, finally received justice for his crimes when the agency gave him a new identity and sent him back to West Germany, where he lived out the rest of his days in peace.
Yeah, it's nice to hear a happy ending.
Yeah, it's always good when the good guys win.
Yep.
There are a lot of cases like this, as a side note.
Definitely.
Plotner's probably, he's probably the most openly abhorrent one that you mm-hmm. can find immediately, but there are a lot of scientists where that was the career trajectory. You go from various Nazi facilities to working in American intelligence to a comfy retirement.
Yeah.
Which, you know, worth noting. Bluebird's operations were primarily focused, as one memo towards the end of the operation put it, on four broad questions as follows. A, can accurate information be obtained from willing or unwilling individuals? B, can agency personnel and persons of interest to the agency be conditioned to prevent any outside power from obtaining information from them by any known means? C, can we obtain control of future activation, physical or mental, of any individual, willing or unwilling, by application of our techniques? D, can we prevent any outside power from gaining control of future activities, physical or mental, of agency personnel by any known means? Close quote. The memo noted that question A had definitively been answered in the affirmative, but that further research would be needed before they could definitively answer the three other questions that the memo posed.
Mm.
So with that in mind, Bluebird's scope was expanded, it was given a little more funding, and it gave way to Project Artichoke.
Yeah. So Project Artichoke, this officially started in August 20th, 1951, and was operated by the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence, OSI, which is, you may have heard of. And the goal of this one was to determine whether or not a person could be involuntarily made to perform an assassination. So, again, another charming, just like, I would just call that blatantly evil mission statement. The project carried out in-house and overseas experiments using LSD, hypnosis, and total isolation as forms of physiological harassment for special interrogations on human subjects. The subjects who left this project were fogged with amnesia, resulting in faulty and vague memories of the experience. It was overseen by the agency's security research staff headed by Paul F. Gaynor. And just as a brief side note of Paul F. Gaynor, again, just to kind of paint the brush of the people involved with this, just so you're kind of knowing about the company we're keeping in these projects.
Yeah.
Paul F. Gaynor was notorious among CIA officials for having his staff maintain a systematic file on every homosexual and suspected homosexual among the ranks of federal employees, as well as those who worked and served on Washington's Capitol Hill. May sound familiar to some of our Hoover heads out there. this is kind of the state of working in this type of business. But in early January 1953, the State Department employee John C. Montgomery, who handled considerable classified material, hanged himself in his Georgetown townhouse after learning of his addition to Gaynor's list. And in 1954, U.S. Senator Lester C. Hunt, a Democrat from Wyoming, killed himself in his Senate office after he was threatened by Republicans using information provided by Gaynor's staff to publicly expose his son's homosexuality. And according to one former CIA official, Gaynor was once informally cautioned by Alan Dulles concerning his overt support of former Congressman Hamilton Fish III, who was a strident Nazi sympathizer, as well as for associating, along with fellow CIA official Morse Allen, with
ding ding ding
bing bong boom,
just Kill Bill siren.
Yeah. But he was also cautioned for associating with John B. Trevor Jr., who was an ardent racist, anti-Semite, pro-Nazi, who called for amnesty for Nazi war criminals. But this was the only time that members of the agency would cozy up to Nazis and racists. I'm glad we both left these sarcastic comments for each other.
Yeah, when we just a peek behind the curtain for the listeners, we were talking, we're like, we won't have as many jokes in here, but we both at this point in our notes got really irritated.
Yeah.
And so we started just putting in snide little comments.
Well, and I think if you're listening, it almost becomes like surreal and very frustrating at this point, mm-hmm. where it's just like how blatantly evil this all is. And just on a fundamental, like departmental level. And it's pretty horrifying to look at. But anyway, that again, that kind of paints the picture of like some of these projects. So we'll hop back into Artichoke, which Gaynor was overseeing. But essentially, all of the CIA's early mind control experiments had this strong element of racism, or like not in any sort of xenophobia, I guess you could say, that mm-hmm. generally manifested itself through the agency's principal objective of establishing control over the perceived, you know, weaker or less intelligent segments of society, which, you know, sound familiar. Back to those silly Nazis. And the CIA's initial mind control activities show a close kinship with many prominent characters within the racist and anti-immigration eugenics movement. And obviously, there's not a coincidence there. That's pretty, you know, on the nose, I think. But jumping back into the stream of time, in September 1953, Artichoke project director Morse Allen, a former naval intelligence officer and State Department employee, hand-carried a two-page memorandum to Paul Gaynor. The memo bears the subject Artichoke Research Program, and it reads, in part, quote, "There are some 4,000 American military men who are serving court-martial sentences in the federal prisons at this present time. These men are scattered through the federal institutions according to their age, some being at reformatories, others at prisons. It is administratively possible that the sentences of these men can be reduced by direction of the Adjutant General's office. Therefore, if these men should be wanted for work on a dangerous research project, it might be possible to motivate their interest by promising that recommendations would be made to the Adjutant General's office to have their sentences appropriately reduced if they cooperated in the experimentation. Also, many offenses of military men were committed in circumstances which might tend to lessen the feeling of guilt on the part of the individual, and such cases might reveal interesting information." End quote.
Ugh.
Yeah, so just nasty. Nasty, evil, bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the sort of, like, cocktail that everything's swimming around in.
Yeah.
When, just to add one more thing to this little smoothie that we've got going. We're just throwing in one more thing into the blender.
Yeah.
We've alluded to this a couple of times throughout the episode, but also at this time, there was an increasingly contentious debate about the United States military's use of biological weapons in Korea.
Right.
Because by this point, multiple soldiers had, contrary to the State Department's statements, confessed to using biological agents on Korean and Chinese forces and civilians. Weaponized smallpox, interestingly enough, was mm-hmm. among the list of biological agents used.
Right.
And the prevailing sentiment in the United States quickly became that these soldiers' memories had been forcibly altered, or that they had been forced to give confessions.
Right.
And that false memories had been implanted into them.
Mm-hmm.
The journalist Edward Hunter, a former OSS agent who was on the CIA's payroll at the time that he wrote this, coined the term brainwashing in reference to these soldiers and the terrible things that they had undergone. And so, with the discoveries and advancements of projects like Bluebird and Artichoke and others, and with the newfound excuse that the communists were doing it first, CIA Director Alan Dulles formally approved Project MKUltra on April 13th, 1953. And I do just want to note, though, right, that was another thing that you get, more, maybe in the more paranoid but not quite fully noided lefty circles in particular, right, is that MKUltra started because we were afraid that the communists were brainwashing people. But I hope part of what I wanted to establish with all of this groundwork is showing it was used as an excuse, but this was already going on, right?
Right.
Like this wasn't a unique phenomenon. It didn't spring directly out of the Korean War. That was just one of several things that were used as an excuse to allow for this to get cranked up again. But other agencies and the CIA had both already been looking into all of these things before it all got thrown under the TSS's umbrella.
Like with a lot of things in history, it's I don't want to say opportunistic, but it's sort of a timing thing too, where a mm-hmm. lot of these things just sort of smash into each other at the same time, and people realize, you know, oh, this could be, you know, our I don't want to call it a false flag, but this could be our excuse for this and this and that.
Yeah. It's never entirely simple, right? It's never an entirely one-to-one, like,
exactly.
This happened, and so we did that, right?
Yes. There's
a lot of interconnecting threads
weaving
together here.
Absolutely.
But nevertheless, it's worth noting, right, that the
Korean
War was involved here. So
for sure.
Just to sort of close things out, because like we said, there's not going to be a lot of MKUltra talk on this. MKUltra just got approved.
Yeah.
And as a final note for this episode, I figured it could be fun. We'll just take turns reading from a memo that was circulated on May 5th of 1955, and it outlined the chemical goals of Project MKUltra. So a portion of the research and development program of TSS/Chemical Division is devoted to the discovery of the following materials and methods. 1. Substances which will promote illogical thinking and impulsiveness to the point where the recipient would be discredited in public.
2. Substances which increase the efficiency of mental activity and perception.
3. Materials which will prevent or counteract the intoxicating effect of alcohol.
4. Materials which will promote the intoxicating effect of alcohol.
5. Materials which will produce the signs and symptoms of recognized diseases in a reversible way so that they may be used for feigning illness, etc.
6. Materials which will render the induction of hypnosis easier or otherwise enhance its usefulness.
7. Substances which will enhance the ability of individuals to withstand deprivation, torture, and coercion using during interrogation and so-called brainwashing.
8. Materials and physical methods which will produce amnesia for events preceding and during their use.
9. Physical methods of producing shock and confusion over extended periods of time and capable of secret use.
10. Substances which produce physical disablements such as paralysis of the legs, acute anemia, etc.
11. Substances which will produce pure euphoria with no subsequent letdown.
12. Substances which will alter personality structure in such a way that the tendency of the recipient to become dependent upon another person is enhanced.
13. A material which will cause mental confusion of such a type that the individual under its influence will find it difficult to maintain a fabrication under questioning.
14. Substances which will lower the ambition and general working efficiency of men when administered in undetectable amounts.
15. Substances which promote weakness or distortion of the eyesight or hearing faculties, preferably without permanent effects.
16. A knockout pill. Sorry. I'm so glad we're doing this together.
It's just so evil.
16. A knockout pill which can surreptitiously be administered in drinks, food, cigarettes, as an aerosol, etc., which will be safe to use, provide a maximum of amnesia, and be suitable for use by agent types on an ad hoc basis.
And 17. A material which can be secretly administered by the above routes and which in very small amounts will make it impossible for a man to perform any physical activity whatsoever.
So here we are.
So yeah, those are the chemical goals of MKUltra. Real charming stuff.
I think, you know, it could be easy to be stoic about this stuff, but you read all of those in a row and it is just evil. And I think we should point that out, that it's just...
Mm-hmm.
When we think about mad scientists and, like, you know, kind of the villainized science that you see in media, this is the type of stuff you think about. And so to find it real from a real 1955 memorandum from a project of the CIA, I think could be quite distressing if you, like me, were not particularly, I guess, perceptive of the government's activities in the last 100 years. I guess that's a way to nicely put myself.
Yeah, it's very clearly the product of an occulted system, right? A word that I'm using a little cheekily, but also very intentionally, right?
Like, yeah.
This is the sort of thing you can only get away with in the dark and when you're hidden behind, like, layers and layers of bureaucracy and classified documents.
Yeah. It's corruption. It's, you know, corruption and weaponized bureaucracy for sure.
Because my internet crashed several times, I have no idea what the total recording time has run to.
We're over an hour.
All right, cool. Yeah. So it'll be about normal then. once we've chopped down all of the... Wait, hang on. Can you hear me now?
I think we did a pretty good job with the simple volume of information we had to get through. And again, just looking back, just as a recap for everybody, we've kind of gone from the late 1800s to the mid-50s, coming straight from Europe through World War II into America, and the CIA, in leading directly into MKUltra, which had, like we said, hundreds of sub-projects and was vast in scope. So maybe, you know, by way of, I guess, trailer, you know, we can look forward to some very interesting things that MKUltra relates to, which is, of course, LSD in the 70s. Patty Hearst is, you know, a name you might have heard that might come up. What else? Research into Pentecostal churches and trance states that MKUltra is doing. All sorts of fun stuff like that. Fun in the opposite of the word. All sorts of terrible stuff like that.
And more immediately in the 50s, you know, we'll also have, we'll talk about, we mentioned him briefly, George H. White, who was involved in all sorts of fun things. We might talk about Frank Olson going back to Edgewood and other army experiments. You know, lots of, there's a lot going on here. So we'll probably go just sort of on a little more scattered. We're going to start taking deeper dives into specific aspects of this program going forward.
And I think it would be impossible to do just a direct linear history moving on from here, from now. Yeah, I think we'll try to keep
it vaguely linear. We learned.
But, But I mean, considering the majority of the documentation was destroyed, makes sense, right?
Yeah.
But we should be kind of diving in a sort of linear fashion into other, just the different, I guess, threads of this tapestry that is so all-encompassing and also so esoteric. So thank you for listening this far, I guess.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for being patient with us. We're sorry it took us a little bit. Our lives went insane. And frankly, the subject that we were researching did not help that insanity
at all. Absolutely not. And you know what? I think in light of that, because it's such a amount of negative energy we've just had to wade through, maybe we'll just end it sort of on a positive note, right? I think that's something, a little bit of hope, right?
Yeah, sure. What did you have in mind?
I'm working on it. I'm getting there. I think that, like, when I say a positive note, I think what I mean is something I found during this research is that, you know, it's very easy to get into like a tunnel vision mindset of like, it's all evil, it's all bad, the world is terrible, and we're all going to die. But it's not true. Take a walk outside, observe intently the birds of the heavens, you know, be calm, and, you know, reach out and talk to people who you care about, because like, there is good in the world. And, you know, while these horrible things are happening and something can and should be done about them, you can't lose touch with your humanity, or else you might end up like one of several of the characters we've met along this journey. And we don't want that. You can put good energy out in the world. I know it's cheesy to say, but I think it's important that we don't completely end on a downer, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't know about
I'll second all of that. Long walks through nature have always brought me peace. If you are of a religious mindset, you know, that's also a thing that can bring you peace and has brought me peace recently. So yeah, when you're looking into these sorts of things.
Not me though.
I'll just second that. When you're looking into these sorts of things, remember to take a step back every now and then.
Yeah.
You don't do any good to anybody, yourself especially, if you destroy yourself by going crazy reading about this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can't completely get blackpilled, you know, to quote, you know, the wonderful Big Lebowski, these men are nihilists, Donnie, they're cowards.
Yeah.
so, you know, don't fall. It's easy to fall in that. I think you play into the bad guys, you know, to really reduce it. You play into the bad guy's hands if you just throw your hands up and give up.
Yeah,
that's my
absolutely
opinion. Yeah. So, but thank you for this journey. Hopefully we'll see you all again soon. We might not immediately dive into the next portion of the MKUltra series. We might take a few breaks because these are pretty heavy and research intensive. And both me and wonderful Matt here are quite busy, but we'll do our best. And with that line of thinking, if you have anything you would like us to talk about, you know, from a cryptid to government malfeasance. we cover a broad range here. Let us know. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram, Historica Esoterica. I don't know the handles. It's been 25 years.
Yeah, it's been a little bit.
It's been a bit, but you we'll can have reconnect.
It in the episode notes, which You'll is to say, it. I'll make Roswell put them in the episode notes. Thank you for doing all of the work on the production end.
Thank you for doing all of the research. I think I'm pretty proud of what we've done here today, so I'm looking forward to the future of this. But yeah, unless there's anything else you'd like to say, Matt, with that, I think we'll say we'll see you next time. And remember,
it's all connected.
Sorry. I was going to say a mind is a terrible thing to waste, but it's all connected. Bye.
'On the purpose of the drug testing, to produce symptoms similar to those that you see in schizophrenia. On how much the patient knew about all this. We didn't delineate all the possibilities of what might happen, because then you contaminate your experiment.
Do you have any idea what volume of records were destroyed?
I do not know.
Do you know who authorized the destruction, if anyone?
As I said, there was a memorandum of agreement between the director and Mr. Gottlieb at that time.
And the director at that time was
Mr. Helm.
We want to emphasize that there are many areas involving this whole incident about which we know little or nothing.
Did you ever consider what would have happened if any of these substances were given to, say, unwitting people?
Oh, I don't remember having considered that specifically. You mean a
hostile agent of another government?
No, I mean
that was probably one of the things they had in mind.
I mean testing it out on an American citizen.
I guess I must seem very, very cold-blooded about this, but I don't recall ever having been very much preoccupied with that issue.
Violence breeds violence, repression breeds retaliation, and only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls.
You're asking whether an individual can be, under hypnosis, influenced, coerced, persuaded, shaped to perform an antisocial act or a destructive act or an act of violence. My answer would be yes.